Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution of the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm Ian Pickus, sitting in for our regular host, Alan Chartok, who's busy raising funds to keep our home station, WAMC, on the air. And our guest today is Jimmy Vielkind, who covers New York State government for the Albany Times Union and its must-read Capital Confidential blog. Jimmy Vielkind, welcome back to the show.
Ian, always a pleasure.
Well, let's start with what's left to do this summer. Only 8 days left on the legislative calendar. And what do they still have to do?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that's out there, but the question of whether they'll actually get it done is still a little bit open. You know, your listeners might remember that earlier in this year, we had a really big flurry of activity. There was that big package of bills that they did, all of which were basically kind of tied to the legislative redistricting lines that were passed in mid-March, about 2 weeks before the budget. And that included reducing pension benefits for public employees who are newly hired. It included expanding the state's DNA data bank to include all crimes. And so, you know, lawmakers, lobbyists, people who are at the Capitol that I'm talking to are saying that, you know, it's kind of, things might end with a thud. So, you know, what are the outstanding issues? One of the big ones that came up earlier this year is campaign finance reform. That one doesn't seem to be going much of anywhere this session. And then kind of the other ones that have sort of floated toward the top are an increase in the minimum wage from $7.25, where it is now, to $8.50, where Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, a Democrat from Manhattan, would like it to be, and sort of the Republican counterpoint to that proposal, which is just a package of tax credits for small businesses. Now, both the Republican-controlled Senate and the Democrat-dominated Assembly have passed individually these things. But, you know, the thought in Albany is, yeah, competing proposals that one party doesn't like, another party likes, they get smashed together, and you do this one giant compromise bill. And it doesn't seem like that's going to happen in the next 2 weeks. There's some talk and some chatter that maybe this is going to happen later on in the year. But, you know, that's sort of what was could have had the workings to become a big ugly, so to speak. And I if I had to make a prediction, my prediction would be that they would not do it during this month, that they will all hit the campaign trail, having done their political posturing in each house, and let it be.
Governor Cuomo's spokesman, Josh Vlasto, has said the governor would like to see this happen, but we don't think it's going to happen at this moment. If they had said something different along those lines, like we really want to see this done this session, would there be some more ability to get it done?
I think so, yes. I mean, Governor Andrew Cuomo has shown the ability to move mountains. He tours the state. He makes a case for bills. He builds public pressure. He leverages individual lawmakers. And if you look at his past legislative record of achievement over these past 17, 18 months, it is quite impressive. So no, I don't think we're seeing a full push from the governor. Yes, he supports it, but he is certainly not pushing this the way he's pushed other things. What he is pushing is something that I do think will get passed. It's a bill to restructure the way New York oversees abuse complaints for those vulnerable people in its care. Everyone from the mentally disabled to, you know, perhaps troubled youth to people who are really sick and in state-run health facilities. Right now, all of those facilities are managed by a hodgepodge of state agencies, the Office of Mental Health, the Department of Health, the Office for People with Developmental Disabilities. And they're overseen by, again, a hodgepodge of different people who are overseeing them with different standards and with different policies for discipline, for referral to law enforcement, etc. So Governor Cuomo, recognizing that there were serious, serious flaws in this system, unveiled, I think about a month ago, a bill to create what he calls the Justice Center, which would be a central place where people could go to report abuse, where these things would be adjudicated and dealt with in a streamlined fashion, which would hopefully be better and get better outcomes than the current system. This bill has already passed the state Senate. Assembly Speaker Silver has said that he intends to move it, but there are some tweaks to it. But I suspect we will see agreement on that. Just this week, we're starting to see some final agreements on things. We saw announced this week the bill to create a database to track prescription drugs. It's called iStop. It was a big priority and something that Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, also a Democrat, made a big case around the state, traveled around, and really made a lot of noise about. And Schneiderman and lawmakers talk about the proliferating instances of prescription drug abuse. I think one of the statistics they cite is that 90,000 people nationwide are going to die this year just from overdoses of prescription drugs. So this bill would reclassify one of the most commonly one of the most common forms of oxycodone, a prescription painkiller, to make it harder for people to get. It would require doctors and pharmacists to enter into an electronic database in real time. So when a doctor writes a prescription for somebody, they would have to check the database to see if there are any other prescriptions. When a pharmacist writes it, they would have to check to see when the last time this person may have had a prescription filled. And the hope is that this is just going to make it harder to get the stuff. It's going to reduce the supply and hopefully help people with addictions ease their way off of it. So that's something that we expect to be enacted soon. The agreement on the bill was announced on Tuesday, and we should hopefully have action in these next 2 weeks.
Well, you've brought us to drugs, so let's stay there and talk about marijuana, which is obviously a different issue, but one that's been getting a lot of headlines this week. Governor Cuomo has come out and led the way on restructuring the way marijuana offenses will be dealt with. Explain that for us. What's the change and what's the outlook going forward?
Well, let's start at the beginning. If you have less than 25 grams of marijuana, which is basically 7/8 of an ounce, it's a little bit less than an ounce, you are not committing a crime. You are committing a violation. It's just like a traffic ticket. You don't get arrested. They don't cuff you. They don't fingerprint you. They basically write you a ticket that says, come to court on this date or plead guilty and pay a fine. It's a non-criminal violation called UPM, unlawful possession of marijuana. And that's if, you know, a cop finds you with three joints in your pocket, that's what you get. You get that ticket. There is a misdemeanor, however, for the same amount, 25 grams of marijuana or less, if that marijuana under current law is in public view. In other words, say I'm rolling a joint right in front of me, or if you're smoking or burning the marijuana. So if you're smoking, you're subject to arrest and you're subject to that higher level of offense, a misdemeanor, which is actually a crime. Now, what had been happening since the laws were written this way in 1977, where they made the possession of small amounts of marijuana just a non-criminal violation. Since then, what has happened is police department in New York City has become very aggressive with the so-called stop and frisk program, in which officers take random people, stop them, frisk them, see what's going on. And this has led city police officials and its mayor, Michael Bloomberg, has said it's led to a precipitous drop in the crime rates. But one of the results, the unintended perhaps results, has been that officers would order people, empty your pockets, turn out your pockets, and say you had three joints in your pocket. All of a sudden, it's in public view, and officers were charging people with misdemeanor crimes as opposed to writing these violation tickets. Now, a lot of people have been up in arms about this, including lawmakers in predominantly African American and Latino communities down in New York City, as well as representatives of the New York Civil Liberties Union, who put out a report on this, I think, several years ago, and who I spoke with earlier this week. And they note that astonishingly high percentage of the people who are issued these tickets, I think it was something like 82%, are actually African American or Latino. 94% of all people charged with that lowest level marijuana possession were done so within the five boroughs of New York City. So what this bill does is it's not a major step toward decriminalization of marijuana, which was essentially already decriminalized, but it was really intended to fix that stop and frisk loophole. It was intended, as announced by Governor Cuomo and backed by the Democrats in the Assembly, again, its Speaker Sheldon Silver, to try and reduce one of what they called an adverse consequence of stop and frisk, particularly on young Black and Latino men. And listeners might know that if you get a criminal conviction or even a criminal charge, it's a major barrier to employment, to getting higher education, etc. So the governor announced his support for this. Mayor Bloomberg announced that he supports this bill, which, by the way, keeps it a crime to be smoking pot. So listeners, don't think that you can go out and smoke your joints outside and just get a ticket. You could still get cuffed and arrested. But Republicans who control the Senate on Wednesday said that they didn't like this bill. They thought that it was drafted too broadly and they want to see a fix.
And the leader, Skelos, Dean Skelos, a Republican from Long Island, said, well, what if you have 10 joints behind your ear, which sort of took off on its own. What's his objection and his conference's objection to this?
Well, that's it. That's his objection. And it makes sense. This could be a tough vote. You could be spun in the political season that's to come as being soft on crime, as, you know, being soft on pot smoking. But I talked to a bunch of police officials here in the Capital Region, including Albany and Colony and Schenectady, and they considered it to be a false choice because their basic point was, who walks around with 10 joints on their ear? You're either smoking pot, which is still a misdemeanor, or you've got it in your pocket. And they said that they were not aware of anyone being charged with misdemeanor marijuana, with this misdemeanor marijuana charge, unless they were smoking it. In other words, for the public view aspect, that apparently has been a problem in New York City.
This is a moment when Governor Cuomo and Mayor Bloomberg seem to be on the exact same page. In the past, that's not always been the case with those two. Where do you see that relationship at the moment?
Well, like any relationship between a mayor and a governor, there's a natural tension and it has its ups and downs. I think that the two men have worked a lot on education policy. There is another bill in the pipeline, which hopefully will be coming up for a vote the end of this session, regarding teacher evaluations. The law now mandates that teachers are evaluated, and as government documents, the question is, should they be accessible to the public under the Freedom of Information Law? A judge in New York City actually ordered the release of New York City's teacher evaluations en masse, and a lot of people said that this was kind of cause for alarm, that you can't see an evaluation for a police officer, you can't see an evaluation for a firefighter, why should you be able to see an evaluation for a teacher? So this is one of those outstanding issues. Bloomberg has pushed for full disclosure, so maybe by getting one on the marijuana bill, he's going to drop one on the teacher evaluations. We don't know. We'll have to see. But I don't read too much into it as a larger indicator of the relationship between Cuomo and Bloomberg, nor do I read a tension or a love in their relationship more than, you know, it's been written or speculated about any other governor and any other mayor of New York City. Again, two powerful executives. There will always be a natural political tension.
I wanted to go to this point earlier when you were talking about what's left to do in this session. It is a busy election summer, not for the governor, but for everybody else in 2012. What influence does that have on what gets done and what gets left until maybe this time next year?
Well, you'll see each house take votes that are very popular for their own base so that they can go on the campaign trail and say, I did it. I voted to increase the minimum wage, and the other side did not. I think that actually the campaign season is why we saw the minimum wage issue play out the way we did. I think Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver knows it's an incredibly popular issue. A poll, I think, earlier this month found 78% of registered voters surveyed, including a majority of Republicans, support this proposal to increase the minimum wage.
And I think it was like 64% of Republican voters. I mean, it wasn't just 50.1%.
You're absolutely right. So they know that this issue is going to resonate. They want to have it on the books. They want to have a record of it. And I think you're going to see it on the campaign trail. Conversely, I think that there's a sense among lawmakers that they have a record of accomplishment already in what they did through the previous two budget cycles and in what they did the end of session last year with the Public Integrity Reform Act, the new ethics restructuring bill that was passed, and earlier this year with the Tier 6 vote and some of the other legislation I mentioned earlier.
Let's talk about the Committee to Save New York. There's a lot of question over whether this is just a New York version of a PAC, a political action committee, or is this, in fact, the state's biggest lobbying group? What's the news on the CSNY, as it's called, this week, and where exactly should we file that?
Well, you know, that's one of the interesting questions that we're facing now in this world of kind of post-Citizens United. So listeners who aren't familiar should know that the Committee to Save New York is a coalition of mostly real estate magnates and business groups from around the state, real estate magnates mostly from in New York City. And they have a small private sector labor union component to this group. And they have been unabashedly pro Cuomo, that they were essentially formed to balance out the big forces in Albany, particularly New York State United Teachers, SEIU 1199, which represents healthcare workers, the Public Employees Federation and Civil Service Employees Association, that in the past have opposed governors. They've had lots of money in their coffers. They've run ads. They've brought governors to their knees. And so Cuomo, who is, you know, a pretty savvy guy when it comes to the political game here in New York, had and sort of blessed the formation of this committee to serve as his gun, the gun in his corner. And what we've seen over the past 2 years is that they are massively outspending the governor's foes. They have flooded, and we're just now starting to think about, well, who are these guys? What are they doing? And then the natural question becomes, what might they be getting? Now, there was a provision in the 2011 ethics reform law that I mentioned that would require the disclosure of large donors to groups like this, including the Committee to Save New York. The Times Union reported this week that the implementation of that disclosure might be delayed possibly until next year. So there's actually a public hearing about that in Albany this week. We'll have to see how things shake out with that. But it was reported that Genting, a Malaysian company that has the franchise to operate a video slot casino at the Aqueduct Racetrack in Southeast Queens, spent lots of money, some of it funneled through yet another one of these groups, the New York Gaming Association, to support Cuomo. So let's break this down, because Ian, you brought up an interesting point about, are these PACs, political action committees, that exist in the context of campaigns, or are they lobbying groups that exist in the context of lobbying? The Committee to Save New York spends almost all of its money on television advertisements. The television advertisements it's run unabashedly and clearly depict Andrew Cuomo and ask people to support Andrew Cuomo. Now, he's not running for re-election, but they're asking people to support Andrew Cuomo. It's unclear that they would have to change their status when the election draws near. So how do you want to file that? If Genting were to try to contribute to Cuomo 2014, the governor's political fund, they would be restricted in the amount that they could give. They would face limits. I believe it's $60,000 for a statewide race, counting a primary and general election. Instead, the report is that this group, the New York Gaming Association, this association of the video slot casino owners, these are video slot machines like we see at Saratoga, like we see at Batavia, that they have contributed $2 million to the Committee to Save New York. The Committee to Save New York spent $4 million airing ads for the governor. So I think that there is an argument to be made, and some good government advocates are making it, that this is something of an end run around the campaign finance laws. It's a way for very, very, very well-heeled people with business interests that could be very lucrative to essentially put more of their money in a politician's corner. Whether it goes into his pocket or on the air on his behalf, you could argue that there's not a discernible distinction.
And let's face it, it's 2012. The governor is always running for re-election. The days of having an election season and an off-season, well, they nominally that might be true, but at some point you are looking toward the next election, and everyone in office is, even if they say they're not.
Well, not even the election, but I think that so much emphasis now is placed on the relative power of our political players. And so one of the reasons Andrew Cuomo is so effective is that he remains so popular with the public. He has approval ratings that always flirt with 65-70%, which is very high. By comparison, David Paterson was down in the teens by 2009, the penultimate year of his tenure. So by doing this, by airing these ads, you're bolstering the governor. You're keeping him strong, and you're essentially allowing him to have his way around Albany. So it almost doesn't matter if there's an election. There is an impact on his strength outside of the electoral season.
Let's talk about some more politics now. The Democratic State Party Chair, Jay Jacobs, is out. He has been replaced by two co-chairs. We heard from Assemblyman Keith Wright on this program last week, and he said he was still figuring out what his new job actually is. What role does the party chair play in New York, and if there are two of them, how does that complicate things?
Well, it'll be an interesting question because different parties do different things. Traditionally, the Democratic Party in New York has been subordinate to the highest-ranking Democratic officials in New York. So for a long time, that was Assembly Speaker Silver. Those were the days when George Pataki was the governor. But the Democratic State Committee in recent years has essentially been a vehicle or an appendage of the governor. And so in this case, we expect the state party to continue to be a vehicle which promotes Governor Andrew Cuomo's agenda and sort of funnels his influence and his desire down to local races, etc. So I wasn't surprised to see Mr. Jacobs replaced. He was appointed by David Paterson in 2009, I believe in the autumn of 2009. And he had been a Paterson guy. He sort of lasted for a while, and frankly, I'm a little surprised that he lasted as long as he did before Cuomo picked his own people to put in. Now, we saw Jacobs was done nothing to oppose Cuomo. He's done nothing to cross Cuomo in his tenure. All the Democrats I spoke to spoke very fondly of Chairman Jacobs, say he raised money, turned the party around. He said that when there was a lot of tumult, when there was the possibility of a very vicious primary between Paterson and Cuomo, that Jacobs was a steady hand that held the ship. And lo and behold, Democrats hold all the statewide offices in this state. So the proof is in the pudding and it's in the results. So I don't know how big of an impact Chairman Assemblyman Wright and Mayor Minor are going to be able to have on the party. I expect that you'll see them have some influence with the governor, but I mostly see the state party at this point as being controlled by the governor.
So we know the Democrats have the governor's office. They have the assembly by a wide margin. They've got the attorney general. They've got the controller. What they don't have is the state Senate. It's a close margin, and they won the state Senate back a couple of years ago, and it ended rather ignominiously, to say the least. Now it's a year when redistricting has taken place, and we really don't know if there's an edge in place for the Republicans in this reelection fight for the Senate.
Well, right, and I think that's going to be the central focus, at least for me, and I think most other people interested in state politics and government for this election cycle, whether the Democrats will be able to ride what in 2008 was a massive tidal surge of Democratic turnout related to Barack Obama appearing on the ballot to retake the chamber. Now, polling indicates that particularly in upstate areas, Obama is nowhere near where he was in 2008. So I don't know how much of a title. I expect there will be an uptick. I don't know if we're going to see the same levels that we saw 4 years ago. The other big question is what Governor Cuomo does. Again, he's a very popular political figure, but so far he has refused to commit to campaigning for the Democrats in the state Senate. And in fact, he's worked very cozily with the Republicans, and many people say that he would prefer to have Republicans in control of the state Senate. That way, he has two parties dividing the houses of the legislature. There aren't two people who can gang up on him, and he's able to be more centrist in his policies. He's not going to be dragged to the left by perhaps legislators who are less worried about how the state's going to pay for some of the policies that they want to enact than a governor who's responsible for keeping the books. So we saw one-party rule in 2008. As you said, it's still fairly fresh in voters' mind, some things that happened when the Democrats took control of the majority. And they had a lot of trouble. They had a very diverse conference, and they still have a very diverse conference, in which many of the members had competing agendas. And since the control of the chamber was so tight, any one senator could effectively derail the entire agenda and derail the course of government, something that we saw quite often in 2009 and 2010. So I'll be watching that. I think there are lots of factors that play in. There's the factor of the new districts. There will be the factor of the economy. There'll be the factor of how Cuomo engages, if at all, on behalf of Senate Democrats. And then there'll be the factor of the overall electoral turnout. What President Obama can bring out, particularly in some of the suburban and upstate swing districts.
In the last minute we have, and I have seen this printed in several places, so I hope it's not too much of a curveball, but the future for Sampson.
Well, Senator Sampson is the Democratic leader. He was sort of the compromise candidate after a 2009 coup led by Pedro Espada and Hiram Montserrat. But he has been beset by difficulties, and he's not a particularly dynamic figure. I think right now he's the consensus choice. I don't expect if the Democrats take the majority, he'll stick around. And I also don't expect he'll be sticking around for the next legislative session. We'll see, but I think that most people are ready and sort of expectant of a change.
Our guest on the Capitol Connection has been Jimmy Vielkind, who covers New York State government for the Albany Times Union and its Capitol Confidential blog. I'm Ian Pickus, sitting in for Alan Shartok. Thanks, Jimmy.
My pleasure.
The Capitol Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. Ian Pickus is producer of The Capitol Connection, a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign. Online at nyscasa.org.